Welcome to the Backstep, where we talk about safety, survival, and other things. Welcome to the Backstep.
Yeah, like the recorded guy just said, welcome to the Backstep, everybody. And it's Ronnie K here in rainy, cold New York State. And my buddy Tommy, who's normally in rainy, cold New Mexico, is now in rainy, cold Emmitsburg, Maryland, at the National Fire Academy, teaching, doing what he does best. Tommy, what's going on in Emmitsburg, buddy boy?
It's nice to be back at the mothership. The weather's a little dicey. It's been raining, and it's supposed to actually go up to like 60 degrees tomorrow.
Yeah, kind of here too. They're talking 60, and then it's going to drop all day, and the rain's going to turn into snow overnight, Tuesday night into Wednesday. So here we go again.
Yeah.
Here we go again.
Yeah, if you don't like the weather on the East Coast, wait a half hour.
Yeah, that's what I say in Florida, wait 10 minutes, you know? Wait 10 minutes in Florida. So what are you doing at NFA? What are you doing in Emmitsburg?
We're teaching the pilot of the new case preparation and courtroom testimony course. I got my partner, Bob Gentile, from Florida, and I are over here test driving the new curriculum and trying to tune it up for the first formal presentation, which will take place in February. So we got 17 students in from across the country that agreed to have the pilot experience, and we're cruising along. We got through the first full day of instruction, and they got to look at their case files today, and they're getting ready to put together a comprehensive report that they will testify to in a mock trial next week.
Oh, cool. Cool. So let me get this straight, just for the record. You hung out with a Gentile in the daytime, and you're hanging out with a Jew at night?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm just asking. You know, I'm just very observant. For you listening audience, I'm Jewish. That's why I said that. And Tom's working with a guy named Gentile. So just it was funny to me. If you're not laughing, I don't give a shit. I had a good time with it. So, you know, if the guy, the men and women out there were saying, what did he say? You know, it is what it is. I had a good laugh on it anyway. What can I tell you? I tell you what I do want to open up with tonight, and it kind of fits somewhere into our mantra of safety, survival, and other things. In case you folks out there don't read the blogs on fire engineering, you know, it's called commentary now, by the way. They call it the blog page. Now, if you go onto the homepage and you click on commentary, all of us bloggers are there, and there's probably 50 or 60 of us. And I started something, 57 or 58 blogs ago, called Chief Canterman's Journal. So it's kind of like I'm keeping a journal on things. And my recent one is about the message we're sending in public education. And Brian Brush, one of our fire engineering associate and brothers, smart young man, you know, fire officer. I think he's from the Midwest. He wrote something on Firefighter Nation on this. Probably, I don't know, 6 months ago, and a buddy of mine from New Jersey, he read it recently and sent it to me and said, hey, read this article. What do you think? And, of course, you know, certain things that I read gets me a little bit fired up, and I got to say, well, you know what? This is a pretty good message. I'm going to forward it out to the three or four people who might be reading my blog, you know. So I don't know how many people read Brian's on Firefighter Nation, But what the crux of it, Tommy, and I'm pretty sure you saw it because I send those blogs out to a certain mailing group before it hits the magazine, was about mixed signals. And, you know, we've been teaching the NFPA has had the EDITH program, Exit Drills in the Home. I'm thinking EDITH is at least 30 years old. Is that a good guess, Tom? Yeah, at least 30, maybe 40 years old, right? Exit Drills in the Home. We teach people, get out, stay out, stay out, get out, stay out, pick a spot, call 911, blah, blah, blah. We've been teaching that for a long, long time. I think that was it was incorporated into the Learn Not to Burn curriculum. It's been around a long time. So now there's a campaign called Close Before Your Those, and it's about closing your bedroom door, which we've been talking about for a long time, you know, and I've seen it at fire scenes where that shitty hollow bedroom door kept the fire out of the bedroom until the fire department got there, and even people who got out shut the door behind them and kept the fire in the bedroom, so they destroyed the rest of the house, and it, so it kind of works, but it comes along in a campaign, close before your door is closed, the door will protect you, the door will protect you, and now the thinking is, well, I'll just stay in my bedroom, and I'm gonna wait and hang here and not worry about anything. So that was kind of Brian's thing. Brian's also his one of his major points was, you know, people expect the fire department to show up and get them and their families out of a bad situation, right? So what we're doing now is we're saying, you know, kind of saying, so we'll stay in the bedroom and we'll come get you. So now instead of having the public properly educated to get themselves out and to lessen the risk to them and us, now the job becomes a little harder for the fire service, because now we're saying, well, maybe you can stay in the bedroom. And I'm not saying that the public educators out there are saying, don't get out of the house, just stay behind the door and you'll be fine. But it's how you send the message. It's all in the delivery, because we don't want to confuse the public. He also makes a good point when he talked about the fact that, you know, we see on the news at night, you know, some father got out, jumped out a window and left his wife and two kids in the house. Well, you know, how the hell can we expect that guy to go down the hall and make the search for those people if we can hardly get down the hall wearing a turnout gear with a mask because it's too fucking hot? And now we're saying, Jesus Christ, you know, look at this guy. He left his family in the house. Well, I'm sure he had to go out the window at that point. So he was kind of concerned about the message and how we're delivering it and the possible burden it's going to put back on us after all the years of good pub ed, get out, stay out, meet outside. You know, I mean, we've had those successes for years. You pull up in front of the house and mom and dad are out there with the kids and saying, we're all out, we're here, we're accounted for, there's nobody trapped in the house. Well, then everybody on the fire ground takes a deep breath and then kind of goes at it in a little bit less of a pace without the anxiety. But now it's like, you know, close before you doze, good idea. It's going to hold some fire and smoke back. But are we sending the wrong message? And so I just wanted to kind of put that out there tonight on the show here, up on the back step, for anybody listening to think about if you're the deliverer of those messages, if you're doing public fire safety education, which every member of the fire service should be doing at some level, or if you're working with a fire marshal's office or a public fire safety education unit, to have that chat with them and say, listen, you know, what are you guys doing? You know, I heard this knucklehead on the radio last night, you know, from New York, and he thinks maybe we're sending mixed messages, you know, and just to have a conversation to make sure we're not telling the public, you know what, stay in your bedroom, keep the door shut, you're going to be fine, and we'll come and get you. We'll crawl through the 1900-degree heat. I don't think that's going to happen either. So it's just one of them things that kind of got me all stirred up a little bit, and as you could tell, and yes, I switched to decaf, Tom. You know, I went to decaf. You know, I mean, doing the best I can. So, but that was it. You know, I don't know, Tom. What do you think, Tom?
There's some validity to it, and if you look at the way our tactics have changed, and especially with vent enter search, and now they through the UL experimentation, they've kind of added the I into that, the vent, enter, isolate, and search, where if they're having to make a bedroom from outside the structure, that one of the first things they should do is make sure that bedroom door is closed. And I think that a couple of jobs have really highlighted the fact that even a hollow core door is going to buy you some time. But I'm trying to figure out, how would you incorporate that into the message of maybe you can get out, and instead of maybe staying in, if you know, the fire is still small enough, get outside. But if things are looking crappy, and how do you describe that to the general public of you should keep your bedroom door closed. If you think you got a problem, check the door for heat to see if it's hot. it's complicated as far as
it is. It is, and that's why, you know, when it seems academic, but I don't think it is, because the public they don't have a clue, and then it's our job to give them that clue, so they're not completely clueless, so they kind of know what to do, you know. So I just think that it might take a little time. And hopefully someone a lot smarter than me in the public fire safety education world to publish an article or three and say, hey, here's how you may want to be delivering this message. So if anybody's listening out there, we're looking for a good article. Send it to Bobby Halton and CC Diane Rothschild at clarionevents.com. Send them that article so we can hopefully try to straighten some of this out, because we don't want to give our customers that mixed signal. And I don't think it's that black and white. It might be black and white. I'm just not the guy to think of it, you know, but I'm sure there's a good public fire safety educator out there who can, you know.
You know, and I think one of the things we can't lose sight of is the basics. You need working smoke detectors to give you that early warning and give you the best chance of getting out before things get really bad.
I went to they advertised this thing called the Fire Safety Summit. It was the Mid-Atlantic states. It was the New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware. Somebody from Virginia showed up, Washington, D.C. And it was hosted in New Jersey last Wednesday. So being I teach for the state, I do recertification classes for fire officials. It was kind of in the mix that we're having our annual summit, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I signed up to go, and I went for the day. It was in Edison in Raritan Center in one of the hotels. And I ran into a lot of good old buddies and brothers and stuff I haven't seen in a while, and it was kind of nice. I met a lot of people. But it was mostly a public fire safety education day. They had the group there that advocates for residential sprinklers called Common Voices. There was a woman there who lost her entire family, brother, sister-in-law, kids, everything, in this huge mansion fire in Anne Arundel County about 5 years ago. I tell you, as long as I've been around the service, Tom, seeing the pictures of that house and that family perishing, it was Christmas tree fires this time of the year. Shook you to the core. It shook you to the core. I came home, I said to my wife, I said to Fran, I saw something today. I said, it shook me to the core as long as I've been around it. So they did that, and there was a whole bunch of things. There was even a short segment on firefighter behavioral health, and there's an organization that's working with the New Jersey UASI region, but they'll work with other states, because other states raised their hand and said, you know, can you help us in Maryland or wherever? So the answer was yes. And one of the principals in that group, it's an extension of a system they use in Israel called Natal, NATAL. And they've put like 1,700 Israeli police officers through this thing, because if you think about what goes on in Israel every single day of the year, they see everything every single day of the year. You know, other than the usual possible crimes, all the other terrorism and everything else. So a pretty interesting group. So that they showed up also, but there was a lot of pub ed stuff going on, and they didn't necessarily talk about this, but they talked about. My point is, public fire safety education is alive and well. A guy sitting at my table from New York Fire Department, I had a nice chat with him. My brother-in-law Tony just retired out of that unit. He was a line lieutenant, and he went there a bunch of years ago to go on days. He just retired out of public fire safety. So we had a nice chat, you know, and we talked about some of the things they were talking about there at the summit. And the city does some of it. Some things they don't do, but there are a lot of oh, by the way, our girl Teresa Crisman from Memorial Weekend from PG County was there. I saw Teresa.
That's Tommy Hayden's work wife.
Something like that. Tommy Hayden's work wife. Yeah, I like the way you put that. Yeah, I walked in. She was sitting there, so we had a little bit of a reunion, you know, and a whole bunch of people. So it was neat. Like I said, a lot of states represented, but it was an interesting day, you know. And a lot of times we don't take that time out to sit and talk with and speak with the public fire safety education people, and they're out there doing it every day, and they're so damn dedicated, you know. So we can learn from them. So they're around. So I'll make that appeal to those folks to get involved. I didn't have the opportunity to talk about this particular mixed message thing, but you know, somebody out there has got to have a handle on this, and maybe. Can get something published so the rest of the gang can benefit from it, you know. So that's that. I had to get that off my chest. I feel better, to tell you the truth. My headache went away.
You know, it's a quandary, I would refer to it, but there's got to be somebody out there that can come up with the good middle ground to make sure that we're educating people that, you know, a lot of it's going to, what you do, a lot of it's going to depend on early detection and try to recognize the signs of maybe you need to go to plan B.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. I agree. I agree. They did a lot of the speakers. They were current. They were very current, talking about, like, you know, they showed a couple of, there's a program for seniors and elders and about, you know, getting out of the house, so to speak, you know, and you don't have time anymore to flash over, you know, once the smoke alarm goes off, you got 2 to 3 minutes tops to get the heck out, you know, and so it's training all those folks how to react, and it's hard for them to get up out of the chair. It's hard for me to get up out of the damn chair now, you know. So don't laugh at me. I'll kill you when I see you. But it was kind of neat to be there around those folks for the day who were doing it day in, day out, and to hear what they have to say, because I just read the report from the President Harry Truman, the summit that they had in Key West, the Fallen Firefighters Foundation hosted that in May. They went to what they call the Little White House. Truman had a mini White House built there in Key West back in the 40s, and he called the first fire prevention summit. He got people together because we had some horrendous fires in the 40s, the Coconut Grove, Texas City, and those kinds of things. He said, we have to do something about fire safety in this country. So he kind of took it by the horns. So now this was the 17th Truman Conference on Fire Safety, and they talk about one of the five main recommendations that came out of that was the fire service in its entirety, the entire fire service needs to embrace fire prevention and fire safety and all that fire, you know, public fire safety. I agree. I mean, I've been preaching it my whole career, but yeah, I agree. Everybody, all the people on the line, volunteer, career, or otherwise, We all need to have a voice and a stake in that. I agree.
Have you read the report that came out from Truman's work?
The original one?
Yeah.
I read it a long time ago. I haven't read it. I didn't read it recently, but I found out about it probably, I'm very slow on a draw, I'm going to say 5 to 10 years ago, I found out about the Truman thing, and I read it. And then, of course, I read the current, you know, what happened at the conference, because they just released the report, you know. And frankly, when you read Truman, you read America Burning from 1974, you read America Burning Revisited 30-something years later or 25 years, it's the same thing. I'm not beating up on the fire service. I'm not beating up on the people who came before us, but we're not solving the problem. We haven't solved the problem yet. Are fire deaths down? They are. I remember when it was 12,000. I mean, when they started to count in the early 70s, it was 12,000 people a year were dying in this country. You know, and back then we had those horrendous fires in the 40s, which is what got Truman's attention. But we still haven't majored in fire safety and fire prevention. We haven't. We were talking about, where the hell was I? Oh God, Friday. Was it Friday? We got into talking about fire departments and actually, I had dinner at my old command last night with the guys. I got invited over for dinner. We were talking about it last night
cool.
at the kitchen table. Yeah, it was nice. Good to see everybody. So I walked in with $804 worth of cake and cookies. Needless to say, the stuff they don't need, but you just bring shit. But we had a nice dinner and we got to talking about the big fires and fire prevention and all that stuff, and we all kind of, everybody kind of agreed at the table, you know, the numbers have changed, but the issues are the same. You know, we talked about Tokyo. Tokyo's fire prevention bureau was 5,000 people.
Yeah.
I recently told somebody That's on. I taught a class Friday up in Passaic County, Saturday, and actually I had the chief from Jersey City, the current chief from Jersey City, Stevie McGill, was in my class. And I've heard about Steve. I never had a chance to meet him. We ended up going out for lunch. Great guy, by the way. Super guy. And we had a nice chat, and we were talking about fire prevention and stuff. And he said, yeah, I heard in New York City the Fire Prevention Bureau is like 600 people now. Like, it used to be like almost nothing. I said, yeah. I said, and for a city that size, that's not even a lot.
No.
The fire prevention went from they went to, they're almost at 600 in New York City. It's nothing. There's 5,000 people in fire prevention in Tokyo. Now, granted, there's probably 8 billion people in 4 square miles, but the last time I read about it, and that's probably a while ago, they had like 2,500 people doing fire safety education and 2,500 people doing inspections and code enforcement. They take it seriously.
You know,
almost everywhere in the world, they take it a lot more serious than we do. Scandinavian countries, at one time, the fire chief was held criminally liable if someone got killed in a fire, and it was found to be that occupancy had violations on it, and they weren't corrected, and they weren't found by the fire department. I mean, there's some serious fire prevention shit going on out there.
You know, I think
we can
back
do better.
To one of my favorite Don Mano stories, God rest his soul. He had traveled over to Japan and had the opportunity to kind of observe what they were doing. And he was telling the story. They had a fire in an apartment building. And he said the typical response came in for fire suppression, a couple engines, a couple ladders, a chief. And he said about 25 staff cars showed up. And they set themselves up on various intersections close to the fire and got on their public address system and let the gathering crowd know that who had the fire, what the cause of the fire was, how they disgraced their family because they had the fire. And I'm just like, Don, I said, can you imagine trying to do something like that here in the States? The city attorney's phone would be ringing off the hook. And he said, yeah, they're definitely more attuned to it as a culture than we are here in the States. And yeah, the numbers are down. I think we're heading in the right direction, but there's still a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's statistically, we talk about it all the time. Statistic, but we know that most people die in their own house between midnight and 6 o'clock in the morning. It's like, that's incredible when you think about that. That should be your safest haven, is your own home, and that's where most of our customers lose their lives. So, yeah, there is. And getting back to Japan, those people have to move. The people who have the fire, because they've lost face, so to speak, and they disgraced them. So they have to move out of that province or that town or that city and got to go somewhere else because no one will talk to them anymore. The guy at the fish market won't sell them any more fish and all that stuff. So, yeah, but it's cultural. It's absolutely cultural.
Yeah.
You know? Well, look at us talking about fire prevention. How about that? But you know what? I've been preaching for a long time. You know, fire prevention means less fires, less incidents, less times that our guys are going out the door, and less opportunity to get hurt and get killed. So I believe fire prevention is directly related to firefighter safety. That's my connection. Love it, leave it, lump it, I don't care. That's what I believe. So, you know, it is
now,
what it is.
In fact, I have used your kind of motto of, you know, fire prevention saves firefighters whenever I do the incident safety officer class. And if we can stop it before it happens, we've saved lives.
Yep, including ours.
Yes,
including
especially
ours.
Ours.
Yes, I know. So
I did. I did come across once again reminded of, and you know what a history buff I can be, but going back to the December 7th and the attacks on Pearl Harbor. And the three Honolulu firefighters that lost their lives during that attack, plus the six others that were wounded. And as you probably know, Ron, back in 1944, all of the folks, the six that were injured, the three that were killed in the line of duty, were awarded the Order of the Purple Heart. And they're the only civilian firefighters to have ever received that award. And as I was digging, looking for some new stuff on it, I came across an older article that Paul Hashhagen did on kind of looking at some of the events that surrounded that. And again, it's just a reminder of the dangers we face and to never forget. Three firefighters never came home after that attack. It was a small number compared to the number killed, but they were civilian firefighters.
I think the first time I heard that the firefighters got Purple Heart, I was like kind of not awestruck necessarily, but like it kind of took my breath away. Like, holy mackerel! I mean, the military thought enough of our guys to give them a Purple Heart for getting wounded in battle, you know, and that they were non military guys. I thought that was incredible, you know, and of course, you know, the last week, the anniversary was Saturday and all that, and if you put the military channel on, you can see it all over again, and I watched a couple of them. Can't help myself, you know. And of course, Billy Goldfeder is sending out his Billygrams, you know, with the reminders, mm-hmm. and he had all the names listed of all the guys, and it's interesting. While we're on Billy, as you know, he's kind of famous for reminding us and keeping us remembering, because we say we're never going to forget. So he's the great reminderer. He listed the Worcester Fire, December 3rd, the warehouse.
Yeah.
20 years already, Tom. I can't believe it's 20 years. Right after that fire, a week later, I was at the NFA taking a command and control course, and I'll never forget it. You rotate positions during a week. Every day you have a different incident, and everybody rotates into different. We rotate on Wednesday or Thursday. I'm the IC, and it's a cold storage warehouse fire. It was the Worcester fire. I had that fire, so. Immediately go, you know, looking at lessons learned and stuff like that. And ironically, about a month or two after Worcester, they had the same exact building, same exact fire in Jersey City, right near the Holland Tunnel. And I was working in Jersey then, and we caught the chief at the time at a chief's meeting, and he just had the same fire they had. And he said, let me tell you something. We pulled up on that place. He says, every article and every photo that I read and saw on the Worcester fire was clicking off in my head like a slide tray. He said, and we pulled the reins on everything, and we attacked it in a completely different mode. He says, we learned that lesson real big and real quick. So interestingly enough, there's been a couple of articles around. Most of the guys who were killed on December 3rd, 1999, their sons have joined the Worcester Fire Department. Most of those guys' sons are on the job. And not just one, like two sons, three sons, you know, that kind of stuff. There's a couple articles around where the boys all stepped up and went into the fire department. Of course, their moms aren't that happy about it, but it's like, you know, it's one of them things, Tommy. I don't have to tell you. It's in the blood.
Oh, yeah.
You know, your daughter Shaylee's, what, sixth generation, you said?
Yeah, generation number six.
Generation six, your daughter is in. So you know, just it's that, you know, it's hard to believe 20 years. You know, you kind of remember like it was yesterday. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a big deal. That was a 9/11 for the city of Worcester. You know, six guys at once took me back to the Walbaum's fire in Brooklyn, 1978. But they lost six guys in a wall bomb, so those are horrendous and dark days. But hard to believe it's 20 years has gone by, and those kids were all they were young kids or teenagers, young teenagers, and now they're all in their late 20s and they're on the job. It's amazing that they followed their father's footsteps. They're interesting.
And unfortunately, Worcester is back in the news again for a tragedy that occurred on November 13th, where Lieutenant Jason Menard became trapped in a fire after rescuing and helping two other firefighters get out of the building. Unfortunately, it looks like conditions deteriorated, and Lieutenant Menard was not able to escape. And again, my sympathies to the to our brothers in Worcester. It's a reality. And again, I always call back onto your thoughts, Ron, that we'll wait and see exactly what happened when the report comes out. But he acted in the highest traditions and honors of the fire service by allowing two other guys to get out, and unfortunately made the supreme sacrifice while doing that.
Yeah, it's when Menard got killed, and the last couple of years, Worcester's had almost one a year for the last few years, and when he got killed, what came across my mind is what goes on up in Worcester? Do they have that much fire duty? And they do. They do have fire duty, and they lose. And ironically, while I'm having those thoughts, one of the wives of a recent past line of duty, I forget which woman it was, I forget which firefighter it was, but one of the wives posted an article saying, the fact that the Worcester firefighters are going to, they call them a three-decker, it's a three-story frame. They call it a three-decker in New England. The fact that they're going to three-decker fires is no excuse why we're losing one or two firemen a year in that city. And that's the excuse. We go to a lot of three-decker fires. So she, and I'm just quoting her. She's saying, this is not an excuse because there are three-deckers all over New England. Massachusetts is loaded with them. And Maine is loaded. Everybody's loaded with them. But for some reason, we're losing a firefighter every year in Worcester, and ironically, around November, December, all the time. So she's saying someone needs to sit up and take notice of this and do something about it, And I guess somebody kind of maybe coached her a little because she said something about training. Maybe it's in the training, or maybe it's lack of training, or whatever, And then Worcester Fire very, very nicely, they made a commentary on her article. And said, well, we've changed training, we've changed the way we do things, but you can't help but think, because you're looking at that same stat every year around this time, they lose a guy up in Worcester, and we're not pointing fingers here tonight. We never do that. We never point fingers on a backstep, but basically a pattern seems to have developed. So we look at that and say, well, what's going on? That's what happened to me. I was like, what's going on in Worcester? But and I've been up there. When I worked in Eastern Connecticut, Tommy, I went up to Worcester a half a dozen times. I saw the new fire headquarters that they built where that cold water warehouse stood. They built a brand new station on that site. They got a beautiful monument to those six guys. Very tastefully done. Very nicely done. Stopped in there on a Saturday once. I had my wife with me. Hey, come on in. Have a cup of coffee. And we talked about stuff, and they heard I was from the casino. They all wanted me to get him in and get him free chips, and the whole bit, the usual firehouse banter, But with all of that, it just makes you sit up and take notice, because they're having an event, I don't want to say on a regular basis, but this wife, one of the wives, came forward and said, wait a minute, what's going on? And somebody's got to take a look. So it's going to be interesting to see. To follow what they're doing in that city to maybe make more changes. Sometimes sometimes you think you made all the right changes and we're going to be fine, and then maybe you missed something. And I'm not saying they missed anything, but I guess they're going to have to look inside again, because now she kind of put the pressure on them. Now she publicly put the pressure on those guys, So not really sure, but it's hard to believe that 20 years has gone by. It's amazing how the time flies by. Crazy. It's 18 years since 9/11 too. So I guess the older you get, the faster it goes, kid. I ever tell you that story, Tom? The older you get, the faster it goes. I was at a college graduation, and a politician in his 70s. He did a dynamite keynote, and he really connected with the young kids in the audience. And the last thing he said was, remember, kids, life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it goes, he said. And he walked off the stage. Got a standing ovation. I thought it was great. It was great. So, so that's the dealio going on up there. I think we'd be also remiss, we're talking about Worcester and the six guys that got killed. And not too far after, I think it was a week later or 2 weeks later, we had that tragedy in Keokuk, Iowa.
Yeah.
Three-story house, they rescued two kids. The chief left the scene. Mark Wessel, great guy. I met Mark, and I was with him for many, many occasions after that happened through the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. A small department, you know, 5-6 man crew, 7 man crew, kind of what I just had over in Connecticut. They come out with the first unconscious kid, and they hand it to him. And it's just him. He's in front of the building doing command, waiting for mutual aid, and he's got a half-dead kid in his arms. So he says, I'm taking him to the hospital. So he jumps in his chief's car, and he's driving like hell, and he left the scene. Eventually, it flashed over, took three guys and another kid. So, you know, when we think about this, we always kind of – Worcester kind of seems to outshadow because of the magnitude, but it doesn't take anything away from the three guys that gave their lives in that little town of Keokuk, Iowa. No one ever heard of Keokuk, Iowa until that happened, but it happened, and it's part of our history, and it's all the reports that came and all the lessons learned that would happen there as well. So we certainly don't want to forget the three firefighters and the two children who perished in Keokuk, that's for sure. What else? I got all kinds of notes. I wrote all kinds of stuff down. I'm on a tear here tonight, you know. I didn't, Tommy, did you see anything further? And I know you just got done working in Colorado for 13 years, but have you heard anything further on this firefighter Jones who fell off the roof of a building and got killed the other day?
Just what the social media had on. And there was a Twitter, I think, release from Summit County Fire and EMS. They just went through a consolidation up there. Where he was working, what used to be Copper Mountain Fire Department, and that Gary Kermode, who actually came out of Kansas, was the chief up there for a while. And it looks like Kenneth Jones, who was with Summit County, was normally working in Frisco, Colorado, but I think they sent him up to Copper Mountain to on an overtime shift to cover some staffing. And that's a big condo area. And apparently it was a condo fire, and they went up to the roof to check conditions, get a roof report, see if they had a way to access the fire from up there. And it sounds like he fell from the roof. And I think if I remember reading correctly, it was like a 5-story condo. He fell 60 feet. And was killed after the fall.
Yeah, I was just looking to see if there was anything like, you know, did he trip and fall, or did he get too close to the edge and forget where he was, or did, you know, something swing around and hit him or something. So I was trying to get more of a detail. I guess we're going to have to wait until they do their investigation. And like we always say, Tom, we'll keep our guns holstered for now, you know. But
yeah,
and
I don't know whether the winter weather was a factor or not.
Right. That's kind of what I was thinking also.
Yeah, they get some pretty serious snow up in that part of the state, but I'm not sure what the weather conditions were at the time of the incident.
Hmm. Gotcha. Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that. You know, in looking at the recent line of duties, the last 6 weeks, month and a half, whatever, firefighter Jones's death aside, it's still cardiacs and vehicle wrecks, man. It's still cardiacs and vehicle wrecks, and we know the health part of this thing and the wellness thing is a long term fix. But guys are still dropping at the scene, dropping after the scene, not waking up in a bunk room in the morning, going home and having a heart attack after work, or as a volunteer, getting back after the call and dying, you know, a while later. So we're still wrestling with the cardiac at or post fire or post incident. So you know, the message to anybody listening is take better care of yourself, you know. And as we get older, you know, we have to get smarter. I've had long drawn out, slug out conversations with volunteers in their 70s. You and I have a very dear friend who's 72, who we saw in October, who works closely with you, no names, who sits at the desk right next to you, and I've had that conversation with him many times. Like, what are you doing? You know, and he's been a volunteer for 45 years. And, mm-hmm. and he's saying, I'm just driving now. Yeah, but 3 o'clock in the morning when that pager goes off, I don't care how long you've been doing it. I don't care how old or young you are. You could be 20 or you could be 70. Your heart kicks into high gear. It starts to pound. You get up. You get dressed. You jump in the car. You drive to the firehouse. This guy's already 72. He's put in two careers in his firehouse already. He's had two full careers at 45 years, okay, a 20 and a 25. And he was a career deputy chief at one time. Okay, when is it over? When does it start? I worry about him. I love the guy, and I worry about him all the time. So I don't know when it stops. But for the younger, that's an age issue, so to speak. But for the rest of us, well, I say the rest of us. I'm an old guy too. The rest of you out there that are on the line, career volunteer or otherwise, you got to take better care of yourself. You got to get checkups. You got to get your blood checked. You got to get an annual physical, whether the department pays for it or not. You got to do it every year. Once in a while, you got to get a little chest x-ray and all that stuff. You take a look at NFA 1582. Bring it with you. Bring it with you to the doctor and say, give me this physical. Most of us on our the non-career guys, the volunteers that have a regular job, you all have medical plans. You're entitled to a major physical every year. Bring it with you and say, doc, check me for all of this, will you? And get it done. Get it done. And if you find something, fix it. Put yourself out of service for 1, 2, 3, 6 months and then go back. But you got to take care of it. Our people are still falling from illnesses and stuff. So we got to fix that. And it's more mental than it is physical most of the time. Nah, I'm all right. Well, maybe not. Cardiac. And then the wreck. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm the last guy you want to ask, when does it stop? Because I don't know.
Yeah, I get it. And I know you moved back to New Mexico, where some of your roots are, and I think you're tooling around with the fire department there now. Are you doing that?
Yeah, I'm on the investigation task force for the county department.
And, all right, that's not too bad. But you?
No,
are you running as a volunteer? You're not running as a volunteer, are you?
No, I mean, if I show up and have to do some work, things are really, really, really bad.
So basically, if they're counting on you, they're screwed. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. But, I fill the role of, either a senior advisor for whoever's running the fire, or, if I can do the safety thing, or if I can just get a head start on trying to figure out what the origin and cause is, it's
right.
Still all good.
Yep, I understand. And it's hard to stop. I get it. But it's like anything else. You got to kind of know when to say when. So, and I'm not sure when that is. I'm not sure when we say when. So what the hell? I'm checking my notes. Interesting story, Tom, out of Sacramento, California. They had a female line of duty, Tamara Thatcher, died of occupational cancer, line of duty death, on the job 31 years, and died of occupational cancer. It's been on the fire wire for about 2 weeks. The reason why I say it's interesting, we haven't seen many females, because the percentage of females in our profession is so small, we haven't seen any data. And as we're getting into cancer prevention and mitigations and all that other stuff we're trying to do, the doctors are telling the same thing, that we don't have enough data from the female population within the fire service. But here's a woman who put 31 years in with Sacramento Fire in California and died of what they termed occupational cancer. And you're hoping that's not a new trend. Start to see more of the females come down with cancer, because they really don't have any stats on the women at all.
I know there's been some initial research, and I think women may have been kind of the driving force behind that, of not only occupational cancer for female firefighters, but some of the other medical ailments that may be particular to our female sisters. And I think they're looking at it, but again, I don't think there's a lot of data out there to really give us an idea what the trends are going to be.
Yeah. I mean, and perhaps, I don't know if that's good news or bad news. I'm not sure. You know, I mean, they've done a lot of research in the last 10 to 15, 20 years on cardiac. You know, our good friend, Dr. Denise Smith, who works closely with the foundation, she's all things cardiac for firefighters, man. And she did a dynamite. Did you see her? She did a keynote 2 years ago at FDIC called The Heart of a Firefighter.
Yes.
She was dynamite. Knocked it out of the park, man. But she's been, and then we got a bunch of doctors that are following cancers and that kind of stuff, you know, and they have a lot of, so we know, like, for male firefighters, we know it's testicular, prostate, you know, and those are the top, you know, in that region, and they're trying to figure out why. Well, is it the turnout gear? Is that where you sweat the most? Is that where your pores are open? We know every 5 degrees, your skin temperature goes up, your absorption goes up 400%. Is that the spot? You know, are we scratching ourselves on the fire ground too much? I mean, you know, this could be a million things. Who the hell knows? You know, so at the end of the day, we have a lot, and the doctors have kind of pinpointed, you know, what the cancers, the common cancers are in male firefighters. But seeing her come up and her picture come up, it was like, oh my God, you know, the women are in the mix now, you know, and it was terrible to see that, frankly. Between you, me, and the other four people that were listening, Tommy, there's four of them now. There used to be three. I ran into a guy on Wednesday in New Jersey. He said, I listen to your show all the time, so now there's four. Okay? Just so
okay,
you know.
Good.
There's four. So we got a brother from New Jersey who's hanging in there, hanging on every word we're saying right here on the back step before we fall off and get hurt. How about that shit? I'm looking at my notes. What else did I write down? While we're on women in care, pick this up off the wire today. As you probably know, there's a Hasidic Orthodox Jewish ambulance corps. They're the largest volunteer organization in the world. And they're called Hatzolah, and they're in every Orthodox and Hasidic community in the world.
Yep.
From Israel to all over Europe, in the United States, in New York City. There's a couple of neighborhoods in New York City, in Brooklyn. Wherever that sect of Judaism settles, they have a Hatzolah ambulance. They're part and parcel to the EMS system. Kind of basically taking care of their own. They're like the Marines, you know, we take care of our own. And so now there's a group called Ezra Nashim, and that means women for women. In those certain sects, men are not allowed to touch women who they're not married to. Even in the temple, when they pray on Saturdays, they sit separately. The men sit on one side, the women sit on the other. When they go to a wedding, the men dance with the men, the women dance with the women. They make big circles and they run around to the music and all that. So this Ezra Nashim, applied for a... not a permit, I guess for a license in New York State to cover some of those neighborhoods like Brooklyn and Borough Park in Brooklyn and other places like that. And they were denied a license by the state of New York. I'm standing
really?
By, okay? I'm waiting. I am waiting. There's going to be a massive fireworks show over this. Because, you know, when it comes to religion, you know, it's like kind of all bets are off. Now, I don't know what the reasons are why they were denied. But if you go on one of the popular websites, you'll see that they have their own logo and their own symbols, and they're EMTs. They went to EMTs, and it's like an all women's ambulance corps that would respond to an Orthodox home if a woman got sick, so they can handle her, put her on a gurney, treat her, take her blood, because the men aren't allowed to physically, literally put their hands on a woman they're not married to in that sect. So it's going to be an interesting. Let's wait and see what happens here.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see what the reason for denial was.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. Let me see if I have it. I still have it up. Hold on a second. I do have their website up. Does the other magazine, like they say? Let's throw it on there. And let me see if it's in the ops and training or safety and health. Let me see. Tom, tell us a 2-minute story while I'm searching. Fill up the air. We can't have dead air time, you know?
dead air.
No, it was dead ant. Dead ant.
Oh,
dead ant.
Oh, that's it.
Not dead air, you knucklehead. let me see, ops and training. Let me try ops and training. It's they're here someplace. I saw it before. I was doing a little bit of research, and I saw their story, and I went, really? How about that? You know?
You know, I had the opportunity to go by the Frederick County Fire Museum last night, and when you and I were out here for Memorial Weekend, they did the dedication of the glass etching that they pulled off that old building in Frederick and moved it up here. And it's on a permanent display outside of the Frederick County Fire Museum and the Fire Heritage Center here, just coming into Emmitsburg. And again, it's breathtaking on the way in. They got it lit up. Basically it's an old piece of apparatus with some of our forefathers, if you would, jumping on the rig. It's a beautiful etching, and I'm just happy somebody saved that. The building that it was on in Frederick was an old firehouse, but the building had been sold. The guy who bought it right after it was a fire station saved that etching, and I think it was actually sat over one of the old apparatus doors. But the building had been resold again recently, and somebody was smart enough to save that, and it's sitting up here, and it's a beautiful display piece as you're coming into Emmitsburg, which has a long-standing tradition, especially since the Academy's been here, of being real fire service supporters. It's I've heard Emmitsburg referred to as Fire Town USA,
because of the
level and quality of education that goes on here.
So what does it look like? You know, when you're looking at it, what do you see?
Basically, it's backlit, and you can see the etching quite clearly of that piece of antique apparatus rolling down the street with, unfortunately, guys hanging off the side and the back step, which, as you know, we really don't do anymore.
Well, are you an eye on there?
Yeah. I
we call ourselves the back step boys, but, you know.
I got to tell you another story, and I was up in Hanover, Pennsylvania, and not too far here from the Academy. They've got a great fire museum, and it used to be over at the Hanover Shoe Factory. They had a spot for it there, but I think they had some structural problems, and they moved the museum into an old firehouse in Hanover. And they've got such a phenomenal collection of antique fire equipment. The sad portion of the show is every time I go into a fire museum, I'm like, I remember using this stuff. So,
I know. So anyway, I found a homepage. I can't find the article on Firehouse, but I did find it. And it's really the whole thing is the motivation behind them was to respond to emergency labor and OBGYN emergencies. However, to serve the needs of the community, responding to pediatric, adolescent, geriatric emergencies. And it's about it's all female, and it's women helping women and all that other stuff. I can't find the article what the issue is with them trying to get a license from the state of New York, but. Yeah, stand by. It's going to be a hoot. It's going to be a hoot.
Oh, yeah.
You guys, anybody out there wants to look at this thing? Because the Orthodox communities kind of they're everywhere, and like everybody else is everywhere. You know, they're not special, but they have this special need, and you never know they pop up in your neighborhood. You know, I lived in North Plainfield, New Jersey, a small borough, and I was a volunteer for 11 years in a combination system there. And it was just a pretty mixed bag of people, but noticeably there were no Orthodox Jewish people in the neighborhood, okay, because they're kind of noticeable the way they dress and all that stuff. And about the year we were moving, you know, all of a sudden we see them walking around like on the main drag, and I said to my wife, well, they must be in town for a convention or something, you know, and then we found out that they – They bought one of our historic mansions, which was, originally it was a mansion, and then it became an old age home, and then they built onto it with more rooms. It was a nursing home, and they bought it, and they made it a boarding school, and just out of nowhere. I was stopped in the firehouse, and I said, hey, I says, I'm seeing, you know, it was a Saturday because they kind of walked the temple, and I said, I'm seeing Orthodox Jewish people walking, going toward the temple, you know, on the other side of town. You know, what's going on? And one of them said, yeah, they bought the McCutcheon home. You know, I said, no kidding. So they, you know, see, so you don't know it. And but it's like any other group. You know, we had an empty garden apartment complex, and in a month or two, it was filled with folks from Pakistan and India. So all of a sudden, we have the Pakistani Indian folks in town. So you never know. So this is going to be an interesting case history, an interesting read. If these ambulance corps start to try to pop up for those populations. And they got up a neat little website here, and they're looking for support and all that other stuff, and they have a petition. And they talk about, yeah, it's a nice picture of four or five women wearing their EMT shirts and all that stuff. But, yep, just another. It says, emergency medical care for women by certified volunteer female EMTs. That's their mantra, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the deal, Tommy. So what do you say we call it a night, pal? It's 8:25. I don't know if you, I know you've been busy teaching yesterday all day, and you got into Emmitsburg on the weekend. So I'm not sure if you have any kind of role at all, and if not, maybe you could just say some general stuff.
I do have the role. The last time we were on the air was October 28th, and since October 28th, there have been 8 line of duty deaths. Back on November 2nd, Brian Serdinsky from Union Grove, Wisconsin, had a heart attack after responding to a motor vehicle accident. November 6th, Dwayne Bradshaw from Pensacola, Florida, made the supreme sacrifice when he was struck by a vehicle at a motor vehicle accident. Back on November 11th, John Singh, the fire chief in Boys Town, Nebraska, had a heart attack after an EMT call. I found that interesting, and the sadness that Chief Singh had passed, but I didn't realize that Boys Town had their own fire department. On 11/13 in Worcester, Mass., Lieutenant Jason Menard was killed after becoming trapped after rescuing 2 firefighters at a structure fire. November 20th, Darrell Rawlins from Amityville, New York, had a heart attack at home after a response. On December 5th, George Johnny Childs from Jefferson, Georgia, suffered a heart attack after a response. Also on the 5th, Robert White Jr. from West Stockholm, New York, suffered an unknown medical problem at a structure fire. And last, Kenneth Jones from the Summit County Fire and EMS in Colorado fell from a roof at a condo fire and was killed at that incident. Again, keep the families of the fallen in your thoughts and prayers.
You know, to try to end the show on a lighter note, if I could, a little bit lighter anyway, while we honor those guys, there was an incredible series of events that took place in New York City recently. I don't know if you saw it online, Tom. A New York Fire Department paramedic had a stroke on the job. So he's stroking. His partner calls for another unit. The other unit gets to the scene, and the paramedic helping the stroke victim has a seizure.
Oh, my God.
So they had a stroke and a seizure at the same time. Both of them were transported at the same time. They were given aid by their brothers and sisters on the scene, and both of them are out of the hospital, and for the most part, they're both fine. It's an amazing story. It's a miracle. It was a double miracle. One guy got sick. The other guy came to help. He got sick, and they survived. So you just never know, man. You never know. It happened a couple of weeks ago in the city, somewhere in the five boroughs. But gee whiz. Well, with all of that, my friend, I guess we'll do the usual sign-off at this point.
I would like to the opportunity.
Sure, go ahead.
Just the opportunity to tell everybody, all our listeners, how much we do appreciate them. And if you are tuned in, I want to take the time to wish you and yours a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we'll be back in, I think we're back in January, if I'm right, Ron.
Could be. And I'm glad you relayed that sentiment. The same from me. Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, whatever you celebrate. Celebrate safely, enjoy your family, spend time with your loved ones and your kids. That's the most important thing. So until we're up on a backstep in the year 2020 with a much clearer vision, how's that for you, Ma? Huh? Be safe, slow down, buckle up, eat right, eat light, stop for red, use your head, watch how you drive, arrive alive, hug your wife and kids tight when you say goodnight. So with that, we'll say goodnight, happy holidays, happy new year, and we'll see you on the rebound. We're out. Good night, Tom.
Stay safe, everybody.
Everybody hates us.